Hello, and welcome to the New Books Network podcast. I'm Lori Flores, your host for this episode, and I'm very happy to welcome Jimmy Patiño today to talk about his new book, Raza Si Migra No, Chicano Movement Struggles for Immigrant Rights in San Diego. This book just recently came out with the University of North Carolina Press at the end of 2017. Jimmy Patiño is Assistant Professor of Chicano and Latino Studies at the University of Minnesota. Hi, Jimmy. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Hi, Lori. Thank you for having me. This is fantastic.
I know. I'm so glad we get to talk because we've known each other for, several years now, right?
And during grad school.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. And so we've been following each other's work, and I'm so happy I get to talk with you about your book today.
Great.
So I wanted to start by asking you to briefly introduce yourself to our listeners. Tell us a little bit about your professional and your personal background and how you got to the position you are today, and also what led you to want to write this book.
Great, sure. I was born in Houston, Texas. My family has deep roots in Texas and the Houston area, and before that in the Texas-Mexico border region. And I think that was really important to my development growing up in the Houston area. I grew up just outside of Houston in a kind of semi-rural suburban area where mainly African-Americans, European-Americans, and Mexican-Americans kind of went to the same schools and the same spaces. And that was just really important for my development. There were some tensions in relationship to that. And, you know, where I found some direction for that was from the stories of my grandparents, who also grew up in Texas and in the segregation era. And so that really, you know, inspired me. And when I went to college at the University of Houston for my BA and a master's degree in sociology. I began to kind of follow those questions. I mean, that my grandparents had set me off on. You know, my main concern or observation was just their stories weren't really in, you know, the mainstream narrative of American history. And my initial question was, why not? And so I had the opportunity to explore that at the University of Houston. The Center of Mexican American Studies there was really important, and several mentors there. Really important to helping me navigate that, and just introducing me to the idea of graduate school and becoming a professor. Right, that you could get, you know, it was cool to realize you could get paid to read and teach and write about these things. Right.
Yeah, absolutely. It blew my mind.
Right. Yeah, they'll pay you for this. So.
Once I knew it, I was like, I'm doing it.
Yeah. No, I really credit Professors Jacqueline Hagen, who was director of the Center for Immigration Studies at University of Houston, and Nestor Rodriguez, and some other mentors there at Houston that were really important to, again, introduce me to that idea. So once I realized that, I continued to do I did a master's degree, like I said, in sociology at Houston. And my master's thesis was actually on African-American and Latino relations in hip-hop culture there in the Houston area, which is kind of my experience growing up in Houston. Also met Luis Alvarez at Houston, and he was on my master's committee. And when I applied for graduate schools, I ended up being able to go to the University of California, San Diego at the same time, or in relationship to him moving to the University of California, San Diego. So that's where I went to graduate school for my PhD, and with the plan to extend my kind of ethnographic research on hip hop to a longer kind of cultural history of Latinos and African Americans in Houston. But when I got to San Diego, this new archive had been just received by the university there, and I began to investigate it, which became the roots of this book. So yeah, that's how I ended up in San Diego for graduate school.
Mm-hmm. That's, yeah, your acknowledgments. I always love to read the acknowledgments in a book, and yours are so lovely, and they kind of encompass your, path to San Diego, all your mentors that you've benefited from and worked with along the way, and just your unique voice that you carry throughout the book. I really enjoyed reading from the beginning, who was important to you in your journey. This leads me into the first question I had for you, which was about San Diego itself. You were beginning to talk about why you chose to make that the site of study for this book because of this archival collection you were exposed to. But what did you feel was missing from Chicano movement history that you thought San Diego, a more, you know, a deeper study of San Diego could offer?
Sure. Yeah, no, it was a real joy to move to this new place where I lived for 5 or 6 years. And, you know, when I live in another place, like I, you know, want to learn about its history and its, you know, what dynamics are there, what makes that place unique, which is how I approached Houston, my home. So that was one thing. I was already interested in that. I wanted to root myself a little bit in that community and by investigating its history. And so that really attracted me to the Herman Baca papers, which were the archive that was received at UCSD. And as I began looking through those papers, I knew they were about the Chicano movement. That's really all I knew about it. And I knew they were about San Diego when I initially started looking at it in my research seminar, right, in my first year. And what became very clear very quickly was, at least to me, that the main theme was around the issue of immigration, and more specifically around the way the immigration system was intervening and in many ways violently interceding in the lives of Mexican origin peoples in San Diego, and how that was a primary problem for this group of activists that I was encountering in the archive. And as I began investigating, you know, the existing scholarship, to my surprise, there wasn't really a lot of stuff on the movement and its relationship to immigration, particularly in an entire study, right? There were chapters here and there on the movement era and immigration. But that's one reason I felt it just really important to begin to document the stories that I was coming across. I also, Luis Alvarez was my advisor. I very quickly began working with David Gutierrez, who was my co-advisor there at UCSD. And of course, his work maybe is the, you know, foremost work that looks at the relationship between Mexican Americans and Mexican immigrants. And that helped me, you know, shape my understanding and conceptualization of that relationship as I began looking at these archives. And the last thing that I think just was really important was, you know, I think I moved to San Diego in 2005. By 2006, you have some of the largest mobilizations like in the history of the country, right, around immigration, around immigrant rights, around the Sensenbrenner Bill's attempt to make a felony undocumented migration status, and even assisting undocumented folks would become a felony, I believe, in that bill. And so hundreds of thousands of folks all over the country from in that spring of 2006 mobilized. And so I also was a part of some of those mobilizations and just marching with thousands of people around this issue. It just really, highlighted how significant the topic was. So I felt compelled to write these stories.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you definitely saw it in 2006 while you were there. And your book takes us back to showing us how long and deep the history is of San Diego being this transnational city, this transnational space, and a place in which we can really see how the Chicano movement, at least some activists within it, were thinking in transnational ways, right? So I want to ask you about Baca, but also about the other activists in the story besides him. I mean, he's, you know, one of the main characters and people in this narrative. But let's start with your first chapter, in which you take readers back into the earlier parts of the 20th century and talking about how in the Southwest, in California and in San Diego, who were the people who were, you know, throwing their struggle in with Mexican immigrants, even if they were U.S. born, and who was calling for that more transnational cooperation and mentality between people all the way back then?
Sure. Yeah. No, that chapter was really important, I think, because so the first chapter looks at what I'm calling kind of immigrant rights, Mexican-American immigrant rights activism, right? From, you know, the 1930s up to the 1960s, where I started looking at the movement era. And of course, that chapter is important just to, I think, to show the continuity and the changes, of course, but some the continuity around that this wasn't the 60s and 70s was not the first time that Mexican-American activists had really engaged the immigration regime and kind of immigrant rights that has these deep roots and in the site of Southern California, right? That these really important manifestations happen. So some of those folks, I really center on, you know, the labor movement of the 1930s as a site where Mexican-American activists, you know, were addressing kind of labor issues, workers' rights, workers' issues, but, you know, inevitably engaged kind of, you know, racial inequality and in so doing with the mass deportations that began in the 30s and later in the 50s, right? Confronting this system that, you know, marks folks as illegal and in different ways, makes them expendable or deports them, right? So, some of the labor movement folks, the Congress of Spanish-Speaking People, you know, I had read through previous scholarship. Many prolific writers had written about them, Vicky Ruiz, George Sanchez, Dave Gutierrez, all these folks. And so they were really important, I think, because they had this idea that migrants were part of the community, right? Part and parcel of the community. And they perceived deportation and kind of the barriers that exist within immigration as an attack on their communities. This is in the 30s, right? So in the Congress's resolutions, you know, they're calling for some of the things that were called for in the 60s and are still called for today in terms of, you know, moratoriums on deportations, that deportations are inevitably, you know, kind of violent interventions into families that split families up, and that they exist as barriers rather than processes in which people can get standing. I'm getting a lot of this from the scholarship, right? But I just think one important idea that they put forth is that Mexican migrants in particular are, you know, not only deserve legal standing, but are owed legal standing for the labor that they contribute into building the infrastructures of the Southwest and beyond. I think that was a very powerful kind of position to take, particularly in the 30s and 40s, that really sets a precedent for what the movement era activists could access, right? So, so folks like Luisa Moreno, you know, was a really important activist that labor union activist, cannery union activist, who purported many of these ideas. Of course, Guatemalan migrant who became a union activist all over the country, right? And many of our colleagues have written about her and given us a lot to think about with her. Bert Corona, I think, was a really important activist who I identify as someone who mentors Chicano movement activists later. So identifying this politics is really important to understanding his continued influence and on a next generation of activists to be involved in those spaces, right? So those are some of the folks.
Yeah, some of many. I mean, you really do cover a lot of territory and a lot of different strands of activism throughout the 20th century. So it really shows readers, I think, that the deportation regime, you know, a phrase we might be talking about today, is actually something that existed long ago. I mean, all the way back in the 30s, they were talking about a deportation regime, or at least mobilizing against one, right? So the title of your book, Raza Si Migra No, does that have a story in itself? When did that phrase come about, and what's the story behind the title of your book?
Yeah, I thought that was a really important. It was a chant, you know, it was a slogan that, as far as I can tell, emerged in the movement era, right? In the Chicano movement, which of course was concerned with systematic discrimination against Mexican origin folks, and you know, of course, strategized ethnic unity, you know, ethno-racial unity, in order to address these issues. And so, you know, that kind of nationalism, right? That kind of ethnic nationalism, I think, engaged the immigration system in a way that didn't see immigrants as, you know, as tangential, right, to Mexican American civil rights, but as part of, right, as part of the same raza. And so I think the phrase is really important as a politics, right? Because that, you know, as I talk about in the book, that connection didn't naturally happen, right? The connection that Chicano nationalism meant inclusion of Mexican immigrants. That was a whole complicated process. But I think when it kind of melded together, this idea of ethnic unity and this idea of immigrant rights, right? It did so through the conceptualization that migrants were raza, right? Migrants were our people, right? We're part of the same community, whether you're a Mexican American or a migrant. And so, yeah, so I thought that phrase was really important for that, and that it came from the movement, right? That it was a slogan, that it was on billboard signs, or, I mean, you know, picket signs and whatnot. Was really important. So I it was an important kind of way to mark the book, you know, title the book, but also, you know, I call it a politics to emphasize that it is a ideological and kind of materialist process to identify this shared, this solidarity across difference in legal status, which again, doesn't naturally happen and oftentimes doesn't. And even within, you know, kind of raza si migra no politics, there's still these fragmentations and these challenges in terms of reaching across differences in legal status, differences in gender, differences in other kind of internal differences within the community.
Yeah, you definitely get into that fragmentation or the difficulties that people encountered in trying to debate or compromise or and just have conversations around whether this solidarity was useful or possible. And you do talk about Baca and Cesar Chavez, the kind of tension between them. Chavez had his own viewpoints on whether or not he wanted to integrate Mexican immigrants into his struggle and in the union struggle. You also talk about Chicano Democrats. So why don't you tell our listeners a little bit more about the complicated relationships between those who did want to practice this transnational solidarity and those who were much more reluctant to do so?
Sure, sure. Yeah, I think that's a really important part of the book and you know, kind of another indicator that I had that this was an important topic was, of course, Herman Baca, still alive and well, is a friend of mine. And he attended, when I was in graduate school in San Diego, he was the keynote on Cesar Chavez Day. And, you know, at on campus at UCSD. And I always remind folks up here in Minnesota that we get Cesar Chavez Day off in California, and they kind of trip out. but so Baca speaking, and you know, he had a relationship with Chavez, and said, you know, history is history. I need to say that the first time I met Cesar Chavez, I got in an argument with him. I knew at that point he'd gained my attention even more, right? What's going on with that? What is that dynamic? And so he said, and we got to talk more about this, deepen this in our oral histories that we did, that, you know, his, the UFW was mobilizing in, I think Imperial Beach. There were some farms down there, which is near the U.S.-Mexico border in the San Diego area. There was a meeting where Baca, Bert Corona was also there, and Cesar Chavez and some of his folks were there. And just detailing this debate that they had, that and he was really adamant about, Baca was really adamant about highlighting the conflict, which is interesting. And I took as an opportunity to explore it, right? Because there's other accounts, Bert Corona in his account, the Mario Garcia, you know, the testimonials of Bert Corona that he writes, Corona's much more cordial about the relationship. He highlights there's conflict and there's difference, but he's much more cordial in the way he describes it, whereas Baca was much more rash in the way he described it. He described it as a very clear debate, a very clear conflict, and there were two different sides, and they were incompatible, basically. And the way he described it was, Chavez's line was, "I don't care who they are, you know, undocumented migrants, they're strike breakers, and they need to be removed. They're harming our strikes." And of course, the other side of the debate was, you know, Baca said, he responded, "Well, aren't these our people, right? Aren't these also poor people? Aren't these also workers?" Which kind of highlights, the two sides of that debate. One that was addressing a real problem, you know, in terms of farm work and this, the strategy of strikes, right? That reserve workers that, you know, interrupt the strike are a real impediment to the goals of the group striking, of the UFW in this case. And so one idea is to remove them, right, or to deter them from arriving, right, which I think proved to be difficult. Whereas the other side of the debate, and again, I think that's why I think of the Congress of Spanish-Speaking People and the unions, the CIO unions of the 30s, is that to incorporate these folks, invite them into the union, invite them into the organizations as part of us, was kind of this other side of the debate. And so so that was kind of a story that Baca told that introduced me to this internalized debate, right? And I tie the where I explore this most is in, you know, that was kind of an anecdotal story that he told. Where I explore this most in the book is in relationship to newly elected Mexican-American Democrats who were elected to the California State Assembly and supported an employer sanctions bill that the Dixon-Arnett bill in 1971, I think it passed, and it gets debated within the community in 72 during its implementation. But it was around fining employers for hiring undocumented workers, right? Which, seems like an idea beneficial to workers, right? So that was the idea that the Democrats had. And I think Chavez's position was tied to the larger AFL-CIO position and the larger Democratic Party position, was that to protect American workers and their wages, right, and their benefits, foreign workers should be deterred or discouraged from being hired, and we should disable the employers from being able to do that. That was the idea around it. But folks like Baca, Corona, and others were against it, particularly because they argued that it would lead to discrimination against Latino workers, that Latino workers in particular would be asked for their papers in such a context where employers were being sanctioned for hiring undocumented folks. And they also kind of foresaw the ways that this was really identifying the workers themselves, migrants themselves, as the problem, as inherently a problem. And so they were very much against that. So that was kind of the specific debate over policy that existed in the early 70s at the state level in California. And yeah, so those are really important, I think, debates that were internal. And I call these newly elected assembly members. So Peter Chacon was, I believe, the first Mexican-American assembly member out of San Diego County that was elected in 1970. And there were a handful of others, Alex Garcia in Los Angeles. And I call them Chicano Democrats because I think they emerged from the Chicano movement, right? In fact, Baca was Chacon's campaign manager for a time. And so, yeah, there's a split that they have between their strategies or whatnot. But it was around Chicano movement mobilizations that these Democrats become, you know, get elected, I think, which shows, you know, that they're part of the Chicano movement, even though they don't agree with these other folks who are part of the Chicano movement around the issue of immigrant rights and inclusion or whatnot. So, yeah, I explore all those dynamics in the middle of the book.
And by this time, this was an organization I didn't know much about, which you talk about in your book, is CCR, the Committee on Chicano Rights. When did that emerge? Was that already in place by the time Baca and Chavez had that interaction, or when did it get founded?
So the Committee on Chicano Rights, so I should say, so Baca is emerging, his activism is emerging in a suburb just south, a working class suburb just south of San Diego called National City. He becomes involved in politics in the Chicano movement in 1968 through the Mexican-American Political Association, MAPA. He creates his own chapter there in National City. And I say him, but there's a group of activists around him in that area. And so in 1968, he's part of MAPA. So he's simultaneously a part of MAPA. He also, Corona convinces the group there to open a chapter of CASA, the Center for Autonomous Social Action, which of course was a organization that was based in Los Angeles that was interested in engaging undocumented folks, providing services for them and politicizing them. And of course, they opened chapters all over the country. So that happens in the early 70s as well. And so that becomes kind of the roots, those organizations, MAPA, CASA. And then in the early 70s as well, Baca gets involved with La Raza Unida Party. So these are all the San Diego County chapter. These are all kind of happening simultaneously at the same time from 68 to 73 or 4. As a researcher, it was challenging to parse that out. Things are happening simultaneously, but I break the book up into organizationally to see what was going on in those different spaces, even if it was at the same time. So it's not quite, the Committee on Chicano Rights is not quite emerged by the time they have those debates. But initially, the Committee on Chicano Rights emerges in response to taxi cab drivers were instructed in San Diego, I believe this is 1972, to report to the sheriff's department anybody that looked undocumented. right? So activists are caught up, Baca, and these activists are caught up by community members who can't catch cabs because taxi cab drivers are afraid to pick up Mexican-looking folks who may be undocumented. And so out of that particular issue, he creates a coalition of community groups, and they call it the Ad Hoc Committee on Chicano Rights. And it's specific, you know, ad hoc meaning temporary, right? Its specific goal was to address this issue of this concern with undocumented migration and kind of high level repression of folks and how it's affecting the Mexican-American community, in particular, this hysteria emerging around undocumented folks being present. So it's the Ad Hoc Committee on Chicano Rights. But then that issue, of course, continues, and it really becomes the center of their politics. So all those organizations by 1976 kind of coalesce into becoming the Committee on Chicano Rights, the CCR. So yeah, by the mid-70s, it's officialized that the Committee on Chicano Rights is its own entity, and kind of these other organizations were the precursor to that. So I marked the emergence of the CCR as an acknowledgement that the immigration regime is a permanent and maybe primary kind of issue that the movement, at least this group of activists, as this group of activists see it, you know, that's a permanent part of their agenda, right? And so for the rest of into the 1980s, they continued to primarily battle this regime.
And this is definitely, you know, one of, I'm sure, several precursors to SB 1070 with the whole, you know, do you look like you don't belong here? Sort of question and freedom with which taxi drivers, police officers can just refuse service, report people, make stops, all of that.
Exactly. That was what was interesting about writing about this topic, this history, right, as we continue to battle these policies, right? So the taxi cab memorandum, as it was called, the Duffy memorandum, Sheriff John Duffy was the one that sent that out, right? The sheriff of San Diego. They pressure him in that department to rescind that memo. And then soon after, San Diego City Police pass a similar or issue a similar ordinance under Pete Wilson. Pete Wilson was the mayor of San Diego at that time. And of course, he rises to be governor and, issues Prop 187 later in the 90s. But the activists are consult the national level attorney general about it, who informs these departments that immigration is a federal issue and that they have no business basically making those kinds of policies, right, at the local and county level. And so the activists saw it as, a done issue, right? The attorney general said it's a federal issue. And so it's interesting how we're still dealing with this, right? We're still getting local police very, in many ways, even more involved in kind of immigration and identifying who, getting local police officers to identify who's undocumented, who's not.
Right. And speaking of other actors who are, putting their nose into the business of immigration enforcement, you talk about this episode with the KKK trying to join in with the Border Patrol and helping them do their job. Can you talk more about that episode?
Sure. Yeah, that was also a very striking moment and that I learned about as I was doing the research, and something that the activists themselves remember because it was so, such a shocking kind of harrowing situation. So in 1977, Jimmy Carter is he getting elected? No, he's issued. Yeah, he went into office in 76, and so by 1977, Carter in late summer issues a proposal, an immigration proposal, for reform to both, in part, do a lot of things, but in part, create a pathway to citizenship, amnesty for a select number of undocumented folks, but also increase the Border Patrol, increase militarization of the border at the same time. And I say that because this is the context in which the Klan members issue their call. Right? So a few months later, David Duke, who still is in the news from time to time, there was discussion of him and his relationship to the current president. But David Duke was the Grand Dragon of the National Ku Klux Klan. And he, late in fall of 1977, comes to San Diego to announce the Klan's participation in or creation of a border watch program where, they're concerned with, to paraphrase them, the tide of color coming over the border from Mexico in particular. Propose to help the Border Patrol patrol for, incoming migrants and even apprehend them, right? And so, of course, this sets off a concern from the movement. Also in this context, there had been several kind of violent confrontations between Border Patrol, local police, and both undocumented resident and Mexican-American folks. And so this is a very tense issue, particularly in the border issue when this happens. The Border Patrol actually gives the Klan members a tour of the facilities. And the way some of the activists describe that is that the Border Patrol wasn't as media savvy in the late 70s as it becomes later. And so it was a really, kind of dire mistake that they made in terms of facilitating Klan members to come see the border facilities and entertain their proposals to help. There's a quote from one official like, "Yeah, we will take help from anybody who offers it," right? And so the activists jump on that. By now it's a full fledged Committee on Chicano Rights, so the CCR is really at the forefront of not only protesting and decrying that situation. Baca makes an announcement that any act by the Klan against our people, as he put it, we will respond with an immediate act in kind. So they very much saw it as a threatening, potentially violent situation. In fact, Baca his home was spray painted on his home, "Go back to Mexico." For a time he was in his home in the evenings and other members of the CCR were patrolling with guns around his home, because of these threats that were being issued, supposedly by the Klan members or other white supremacists.
Woman is so illustrative. I mean, the whole "Go Back to Mexico" slogan, it's what people can point to and say, this is what's at stake here. It's not just certain people who this, slogan is directed towards. It's anybody of Mexican or Latino descent who is assumed to just not belong in various ways or to not be important or to not be valued.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think interesting about Baca is, he traces his family roots to New Mexico and some of the original kind of Spanish settlements of that area. So his family had actually been in what we would call today the United States well before it was part of the United States, yeah, or even Mexico. So, so this event is really important in that regard. And I think what was an important response the CCR had to this was not only to say, the Ku Klux Klan is bad and threatening and violent, but to tie the KKK's position with President Carter's proposal. And the way they did that was that just the Carter proposal, particularly around the militarization part of the proposal, is not that different than, you know, it's just a more covert way of saying that, you know, Mexicans are inherently a problem at the border. And we need to use, you know, law enforcement measures to control that flow of people across the border, right? Which they've interpreted, that's violent. In their experience of that 10 years or so of the CCR activist engaging the issue of immigration was that law enforcement solutions to immigration, their experience in the borderlands was that people die or people get shot or people get beat or people get apprehended or people get separated from their families. You know, it sounds like a good idea in the proposal in terms of what will just deter people from coming. But their main point was that the law enforcement way of deterring folks from coming means violence in our communities. And that's not that different from what the Klan is saying. It's based in this longstanding kind of racialized notion that Mexicans are inherently a problem, and this border region with Mexico is a problem. We need militarized solutions to solve that problem. So I think that was a very important part of their response, that they didn't just respond to the overt racism of the Klan, but tried to tie it to more so, you know, quote unquote, colorblind policies that end up targeting certain racialized communities.
And your last chapter, chapter 8, you talk about the Chicano National Immigration Conference and Tribunal. And this was a moment in which the violence and the pain and the abuse and the trauma that comes to people in their experience of the border and the borderlands is trying to, you know, talk back to this erasure that can happen if we don't address that real pain and violence that's going on there. So could you, before we talk about your conclusion, can you say a little bit more about that tribunal and what went on there?
Sure. So there were two key events in 1980, the National Chicano Immigration Conference, and then 1981, the National Chicano Immigration Tribunal. The conference was called to invite at a national level a Chicano movement, immigrant rights, social service, community organizations to come together to basically create solutions to the immigration problem through the lens of people in the community, through the lens of people actually doing that work of organizing those communities and confronting and responding to systematic violence that was happening to those communities. And that was an important shift, I think, because the CCR in particular sought kind of official channels of government to solve those problems. They went to their council member, to their state legislator, to their federal legislators, right, to try to solve the problem. And through their experience, became radicalized by the ways that there was not an efficient response to these concerns around, again, you know, killings and deaths and violence. Right. So this move to create a conference where the community decides for itself what its priorities are and what its solutions are was an important kind of shift and kind of in a response to the inability or refusal of official channels of government to respond to what they saw as a crisis. And so at the conference, you know, they folks from all over the country come, more than 1,000 folks come. And, you know, a set of resolutions is put forth, one of which I highlight a call to abolish the Border Patrol and abolish kind of deportation-based immigration policies. And I think that, again, was a result of, I think, a radicalization and experience with the sustained violence that these activists had encountered for at least a decade. So I think it's a very important idea that they come up with, the idea of abolition of the Border Patrol, right? And to kind of start from scratch, that it's inherently that this agency, INS, they identified Immigration and Natural Relations Services, Border Patrol, is inherently anti-Mexican. And like, we need to scrap it, right? And I want to say too, that they were in dialogue with Black Power activists, with African-American activists, in the ways that they began to depict immigration as a system, as a system of labor exploitation. And therefore, that it could not be reformed. It needed to be rid of, needed to be destroyed, right, is what they proposed in at this conference. Another part of the conference proposed that a tribunal be held so that survivors and folks who didn't survive, but representatives of those folks, could tell their stories and they could be recorded. Right? So a year later, they reconvene, a smaller group reconvenes with a kind of council that they choose of national Chicano and Latino figures, where folks testify about the brutalities that they had experienced. So they create a document that records these experiences of violence. Again, everything from young children passing away because of complications at the border, to sexual assault, to other kind of, you know, raids in people's homes and families' homes, raids in churches, raids at schools, are all recorded and put in this document. And eventually sent to, by now President Reagan is beginning his term, the tribunal documentation is sent to President Reagan and President Jose Lopez Portillo in Mexico, as a kind of testimony of what deportation-based immigration policies kind of do to these communities.
And I wanted to talk about your conclusion, which is quite powerful, because I think what I'd like to end on in talking about your book is just how much it can inform our present situation. A lot of your book is about, or a major theme of the book is about, the compromises and the bargains that immigration reformers or Chicano activists have made in the past or are still making in the present moment that miss opportunities to envelop many more people in the struggle and as supporters, right? So is there anything you feel that you'd like to say about the current moment in relation to what your book tries to communicate to its audience?
Sure. Yeah. No, I think the conclusion of the book, you know, explores kind of this moment of, well, in 1986, when the Immigration Reform and Control Act is passed, which, you know, gives amnesty to a large number of undocumented folks. It has a very important impact on society. I think that those, I think upward of 6 million folks become citizens through IRCA, through this bill that's passed in 86. But which again also increases the militarization of the border and kind of leaves, you know, doesn't address the root of the problem around how undocumented folks serve important roles in terms of labor. And so, you know, movement activists debate this, you know, coming up to the passage of that in 86 and then the aftermath of it. And I think it's important because, you know, for some activists to, so I epitomize this through the relationship between Bert Corona and Herman Baca. Corona, again, is this longstanding activist with roots in the 1930s, really the mentor of folks like Baca and many others. They somewhat differ in their reaction to the passage of this bill, you know, Corona and his group, the Hermandad Mexicana, take you know, use the passage of the bill in order to get funds to educate more people. He sees it as an opportunity to politicize those who qualify for citizenship, right? Baca, in turn, sees it as we're working with, you know, you're proposing working with the very group of folks who we just said need to be abolished, basically. in his kind of fiery language, he would put it in terms of you're working with the equivalent of the Gestapo, right? To Mexican peoples. The INS is the KKK of the Mexican people, right? So what are we doing? Kind of taking funds from that organization, working with that organization. We want to rid of this organization, right? Not work with it or whatnot. And I think, and it's much more nuanced than that, I think. And I try to detail that in the book, how both sides have important points to make in terms of politicizing a new generation of folks who do receive citizenship, but also being critical towards compromise, right? The notion of compromising that some of the immigration regime can stay in place, like this notion that inherently, again, a solution to the immigration problem is law enforcement. I think that's what this group of activists from San Diego, what they leave is this idea that that is not necessarily implied, right? That's not necessarily the best way to go. In fact, it's very dangerous for the ethnic Mexican community to be subject to such an idea, right? And that we've accepted it as part Democrats and Republicans alike, and even folks within the activist community have accepted to some degree that deportations are okay, or at least tolerated in order to gain some rights for some other group of folks, for a select few undocumented folks, right? And I think we're still in that moment, right? This politics of compromise where, the left, the liberal bill, that is proposed to be passed that will give amnesty, still concedes to militarization at some level. And right, we're still battling that. In fact, thinking about how I've talked this out with my Chicano history class, the current moment with DACA, recipients, and it's the threat on those the group of DACA recipients, right, has us debating whether folks who came here as children should be citizens or not, or should be able to stay or not, right, and have access to a road to citizenship, which, that's kind of a very narrow way to debate the issue. We're not talking about how maybe their parents or maybe kind of the root cause of a lot of folks migrating here without papers has to do with labor and with creating a vulnerable workforce that is exploitable, right? And so in many ways, we're missing that that part of the debate. We can't even entertain that part of the debate is if what we're debating is whether, folks who were children that came here should stay or not. Of course they should. But beyond that, what is this regime doing as a system in terms of how does it? It's always said that the immigration system is broken. These activists were saying, no, it works very well in terms of creating undocumented people so that they can be vulnerable workers. And yeah. That part of the debate really, I think, needs to be centered again.
Mm-hmm. And take somebody strong enough, or many people strong enough, in order to bring that to the forefront. Because I think a lot of people want to smother that reality.
Absolutely. Yes.
Yeah. Well, I really want to congratulate you on creating a book that not only gives, a deeper history of San Diego and its role, its very important role in the Chicano movement, but also a book that can speak to and be interesting to audiences interested in contemporary immigration issues. So it definitely needs to be celebrated. But I was wondering if there's anything new you're working on right now that you're excited about.
Sure. Yeah, I'm actually working on an essay that's thinking about, as part of a larger work and the legacies of the Chicano movement, where I want to look, I'm looking more nationally at kind of immigrant rights activism after 1986. My main question is, the book ends in 86 and kind of with this amnesty kind of demobilizes the movement. But we have these very strong ideas, again, about abolition, about, you know, the INS as kind of inherently anti-Mexican. I'm investigating what happens to those ideas from 86 to the early 90s, where important legislation, kind of Operation Gatekeeper, further militarizes the border. NAFTA, of course, is passed that, you know, and encourages more undocumented migration in many ways. You know, what happens to these ideas in between that crucial period, to try to bring it a bit closer to understanding how we got to this moment?
That sounds great. I can't wait for that. But in the meantime, everybody should check out Jimmy Patiño's book, Raza Si Migra No, Chicano Movement Struggles for Immigrant Rights in San Diego, recently out with the University of North Carolina Press. Jimmy, thank you so much for joining me on this podcast today.
Thank you, Lori. Appreciate it.
And thank you all for tuning in to the New Books Network. I'm Lori Flores, your host for this episode. And we've just heard from Jimmy Patiño, the author of Raza Si Migra No, published in late 2017. I invite you all to like and follow our New Books Network social media pages on Twitter and on Facebook. And thank you for listening.